Microbes in our food is generally considered a bad thing. E. coli and salmonella are unwelcome guests to our meals. But what about those microbes that do good work? We want them, and it turns out we kind of like what they make. Wine and cheese or hard cider to kimchi or sauerkraut and cheese, the microbes responsible for fermentation are the good guys, and fermentation is the topic of today's episode. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 163.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello folks, Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. It is close enough to Thanksgiving now that getting recipes in order is in order. Head over to my blog, culinarylibertarian.com, and click the Thanksgiving tab at the top to get organized and print out your recipes you'll want to make this year. Meriwether returns to the show. Mark has been on twice before, the first time to discuss foraging in your front yard, and the second to discuss his medicine man business and health and wellness from plants. Today we're talking about fermentation, a bit about how to do it, but also why and what for. Hello, Mark. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Hey, I always love talking about food.
Well, we're going to do that. Before we get into that, just give the listeners a quick reminder of who you are, your background, and why that's relevant to today's talk about fermentation.
Oh, okay. So I'm Mark Meriwether Vorderbruggen, PhD chemist. Background is master's in medicinal chemistry, PhD in physical or organic chemistry, but I've always focused on natural products, which has led me through a very fascinating career, most recently as the medicine man for Medicine Man Plant Co. But I'm actually internationally recognized expert on edible and medicinal plants, and not just identifying them, but how to actually use them in all sorts of ways. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about today.
It is. This talk started by a post you had shown about fermentation. I said, wow. Now, I know a little bit. I've made beer a couple of times, and I've practiced at making sauerkraut a couple of times. So I understand, well, nearly nothing. So there are a few things that are obvious. People know, oh, well, obviously beer is fermented. Mead, ciders can be fermented, wine, sauerkraut, kimchi, yogurt, sour cream. That's pretty plain. People get that part. What might be less obvious would be sourdough breads, or even some from a baker. I can ferment breads that aren't officially sourdoughs, and that still creates a better flavor. Cheeses, and there's probably some other things I'm missing. But let's go back to your roots of the beginning of what is fermentation?
Okay, great question. So fermentation at its simplest form is some sort of food preservation using yeast or bacteria or the waste products from yeast or bacteria to produce an environment that is no longer good for unhealthy microbes. So you had mentioned things like milk and yogurt and fruit and wine sort of thing. There's really two classes of fermentation. And by classes, what we're actually meaning is the end products that ends up making this, I don't want to use sterile environment, but this environment that doesn't work for most bacteria and microbes. So with yeast, which you think of in bread and wine, it is actually a fungi. It takes sugar, natural sugars occurring, in whatever plant material, breaks it down into ethanol, which is a great thing. We love making ethanol. Every culture has figured out how to take some sort of sugary or starchy food and ferment it using wild yeast floating in the air, this wild fungi, and making ethanol out of it. We can do a whole nother class on that some other time. Today, what we're going to talk about is the bacterial form of this fermentation. So using lactobacillus, which covers quite a few different types of bacteria, it's like a family of bacteria. But what they do is, well, they have two special powers. One, they're pretty much resistant to salt. So if you have them in a saltwater brine, they can still survive fine where a lot of the other bad microbes end up dying or at least being weakened.
That's why pickles work.
Exactly. Huh. Exactly. So it's not the pickle, you got the vinegar to make it acidic, which helps, and then the salt to also help kill things. In the case of the lactobacillus, again, this would be things for like yogurt, kimchi, sauerkraut. These bacteria eat the sugar and then excrete lactic acid. Lactic acid, just to go sideways for a second, if you're working out really hard and your muscles are starting to get fatigued, your body is getting tired, it's from a buildup of lactic acid. Our muscles produce lactic acid when we burn sugar to do energetic sort of things. But in this case, this bacteria produces a lactic acid. It can build up to a point where eventually it's even too much lactic acid for the bacteria to survive, but it also prevents anything else from growing in there too. So the fermentation with the lactobacillus, whether it be milk to make yogurt or sour cream sort of thing, or cabbages to make sauerkraut, it's a way of making that food, an ecosystem that's unfavorable to anything but the lactobacillus, which is actually harmless to us and even has some health benefits for us. If you think about the stomach, we have the gut bacteria.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Yeah, okay. We can go now or we can go later, whenever you want.
Well, I want to take a few baby steps here. So
okay.
When at some point, and the timeline isn't really relevant, but at some point, Og and Sally figured out that taking these particular plant things or whatever they had and combining certain ingredients in a particular way, and after they ate them, one, it probably was at least pleasant to eat, because people aren't going to eat things generally that are unpleasant to eat, even if they're good for you. Cod liver oil is an example. So something happened in the process of that. They ate it. They said, this is kind of good. And they also discovered that they didn't die. So, hey, not dying is really good. We like this. So let's do some more of this. Part of the wonderment is, has fermentation in things like kimchi and sauerkraut and some just like really basic stuff, taking milk and turning it into sour cream. Now, I know that today you go to the store and buy buttermilk, and it isn't really the thing you would make if you were on a dairy farm and making butter. The leftover liquid is the buttermilk. And I think, now this is where my knowledge falls apart. Did they use it immediately as that, or did they let it? Did it? So two questions. Did it already have some beneficial enzymes in there that allowed it to ferment, or was it introduced by the farm environment, and then did they let it ferment? Do you know anything about buttermilk?
Okay, so the answer to that is all of the above. So buttermilk, and a simple way of doing cheating is you just get whole milk and add a little lemon juice, lime juice, or vinegar to it, and it separates out into a farmer's cheese, kind of like feta cheese crumbles, right. And then the remaining part is the buttermilk, the stuff that isn't coagulated milk fat and milk proteins. From that, yeah, they could use that as is and just drink it for benefits, or they could let it just kind of ferment and sour. It's already going to be somewhat sour. So it's already partially along the path to having that lactobacillus in there. And again, most of that just comes from the air. Our environment is filled with bacteria. The lactobacillus is kind of chilling out. It's, if you think of Game of Thrones, where you have all these different warring parties all trying to capture, say, this leaf, there's all sorts of bacteria on it, and they pretty much are at an impasse. They're all reach a point where it's fairly equal. No one has an advantage over another. So the lactobacillus and the E. coli and whatever else is all sitting there, and they're not one can take over all of it. But then if you take this milk or this the leaf and dump it in salt water or add salt to it, and suddenly the E. coli is like, ah, no, and it dies. And now the lactobacillus is, I now rule. And so there's still lactic acid in that whey, the buttermilk, that's part of the sour sort of thing. So along with lactic acid, there's also going to be some small amounts of glucose and sugars that are just naturally in the milk. I don't have a good idea percentage-wise how much is going to be in there. But the lactobacillus, it's not going to be killed by the situation. It's actually, I'm okay with this situation. Once you have that, then you can take bits of it to trigger, you get your whole milk and you put a couple of drops from yesterday or 2 days ago whey into it, and it speeds up the yogurt making sort of thing. You're adding that active culture to it.
You mentioned ethanol, and that every culture has figured out how to make, obtain, produce, procure, trying to be fancy. From a baker's standpoint, and sourdough bread, when a baker is mixing his starter, and sometimes they make fairly decent, like a gallon or so, if you let that sit on the counter for a couple of days, what happens is, and bakers who will say, yeah, this is true, it's kind of this grayish-looking liquid that rises to the top. And if you remove the plastic and put in, I don't advise doing this, although it's worth doing just for once for the experience. Don't say I didn't warn you. Put your nose right there and give it a big snootful, and it's going to knock on your butt because it's extraordinarily potent. Now, they call that hooch, which has turned out to be what we now use, as a prohibition term for alcohol of dubious quality. Yeah. But that stuff on top of the bread starter is a pretty good percentage of alcohol from all of these things happening. Now, one of the things that I do know as a baker is yeast doesn't work alone. Now, maybe the most famous sourdough bread that people would say, oh yeah, I've heard of that, is the San Francisco Bay Area sourdough bread. Now, it isn't the yeast that does that, and everyone thinks it's the yeast that's special. The yeast isn't special, although it kind of is, because it grows only in that area, and there are, a couple million kinds of yeasts. The thing that makes that bread special for that area is its symbiotic relationship with the bacteria that grow in the San Francisco Bay Area. So you can do the exact same thing in Kansas and use your local fresh. You've got yeast in the house. You can capture the yeast by making this starter. And the bacteria local to you, it won't be the same as San Francisco. But here's the thing. In San Francisco, they can't make Kansas City sourdough bread either. So there's these two things working together, I think, is beginning to get to the point where now we can talk about these two things creating an inhospitable environment for what we would call pathogens, things we do not want to consume, and creating a hospitable environment for things we do want to consume. And why we want to consume them is for the aforementioned gut microbiome, which I've talked about on the show a couple of times. So let's go ahead and get in the gut. Okay. So what's going on in our gut when we eat things that are good for us, like sauerkraut or a good zesty garlic pickle?
Okay, let's back up because you mentioned Og and Sally, and I love that. And you said they discovered, hey, if I let this stuff rot, basically, but it's not rotting, it's undergoing fermentation, suddenly it tastes better. So one of the issues with a lot of wild foods, the foods of our ancestors, they were quite bitter. And a couple of things you can do to remove some of the bitterness if you have the technology, which sounds like an easy thing to do, but way back in Og and Sally days, boiling it really wasn't something they had easy access to.
Right.
So they would normally have to either selectively breed it to try and make it less bitter, but in doing so, you also lose a lot of nutrition, or you mix it with something sour. The tongue has a hard time tasting sour and bitter at the same time. And so the lactic acid that is produced by this fermentation is sour. It rendered a lot of bitter foods now significantly tastier and edible. So that had a great effect. It's like, hey, this dandelion, now it tastes pretty good. Cool.
Dandelions are bitter.
Yeah, dandelions are bitter.
It might be the bitterest green I can think of.
Oh, then you haven't tried things. try some whorehound sometime if you can get whorehound. Ooh, boy.
I like the whorehound candy. I've never had the plant.
Yeah, it's before hops, whorehound and yarrow were two of the things that were used as the bittering agent in beers. They're very bitter.
Huh.
Okay, so now Og and Sally are eating this stuff. And they're going, wow, this tastes so much better. They're also going to start noticing some other things going on with their body. So one thing that's going to happen is they're going to realize they're having less overall stomach distress from stomach sicknesses. So this lactobacillus, it can survive in our stomach. It is a favorable environment for it. And one of the things it does when it's there, going back to that whole Game of Thrones sort of thing, there are certain E. coli and bad water protozoas and things that can cause food sickness. If you have a really strong, healthy colony of the lactobacillus growing in your gut, they quickly overwhelm any of the bad microorganisms that might end up there. So they help protect you from different foodborne illnesses. That's pretty awesome.
Yes, it is.
The other thing is because their biochemistry is different from our biochemistry, there are certain things that we will consume that the lactobacillus can break down and digest that we cannot. But in doing so, what they excrete are nutrients we can use. So there's a symbiotic relationship between us and them. We are giving them a home and certain food. In return, they are giving us more nutritional value from the food we're eating, which is always great for health.
Can you give an example of a couple of foods like that, that we can't break down, but our guests can?
Ooh, so without going too sciencey, so a lot of the things you find in plants are a particularly good example. We are really good at digesting meat and animal products. We're a little trickier on plants, but plants are... the cellulose and things like that mm-hmm. we're not great at. Well, we can't break down cellulose. Our digestive juices are not designed to break down cellulose, but there are cellulosic like compounds besides just cellulose in the plant material that these lactobacillus can break down and free up the carbons and the sugars that are trapped in this matrix of chemistry, if you will.
So is that like asparagus? Because that's just basically it's a grass.
Yeah, asparagus. Well, any plant material, really. So if you're eating any sort of plant or fruit, the fiber, the skin, all that sort of stuff, there's stuff that the lactobacillus can eat a lot better than we can. That's why cabbage is such a great thing for making like sauerkraut out of. There right. is a lot of compounds in the cabbage that the lactobacillus love. And they can break it down and make it much more digestible for us along with the flavor.
So from a cooking standpoint, one, cooking makes things that would be either unpalatable or inedible, both palatable and edible. So that's breaking down, if anybody who's ever made corned beef and cabbage knows that you're taking this hard thing of cabbage and it comes out is just like, it's like paper. But man, does it taste good. You have all that corned beef juice, yum, yum, yum. Mm-hmm. So the heat transformation of breaking down the cellulose into something that is more tolerable to the human, and then we give it to the lactobacillus and said, here, have at it. Oh, man, it's a birdie. Okay, so.
Yeah. And actually, I thought of a really good compound along those lines. So yes. Onions are loaded with a complex carbohydrate called inulin. Not insulin, but inulin. The human body cannot access that inulin. That it's a very branched starch that our digestive juices can't just get in there and break apart. The lactobacillus and the other gut flora can break that starch down into less complex starches that we then can digest. So they help us, you know, like with onions or burdock root or even carrots, some of the starchy roots and tubers, Jerusalem artichokes, also known as sunchokes, have a high percentage of inulin in them. One of the Jerusalem artichoke, it is considered a tuber not fit for company because one of the side effects is it produces a lot of stomach gas in people.
Yes. It
leads to farting a lot. And what's is the lactobacillus breaking down that complex starch. But in the process, one of the side effects from it or one of the waste products is methane gas and some sulfides that you then have to let go.
Gotta go somewhere. Yeah.
But on the other end, you're getting, you know, nutrition from the Jerusalem artichoke that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get.
I don't want to derail my own show, but I am a little bit curious because I'm thinking to myself that there sounds like things like raw carrots, raw Jerusalem artichokes, and I've worked with them before, and they make a very, very fine paste, perfect for thickening sauces naturally and immediately. I love parsnips. Those things are tough, and do not eat a raw parsnip. You won't be happy. if I ate the raw parsnip, I expect probably based on what I just learned that the gut flora is going to say, hey, no problem. I can take care of this for you. And it might make a bit of a windy day, but, I guess the easy question to ask without getting too far into it, is much compromise lost and gained through cooking? Is the end result mostly net neutral?
Okay, great question. And the answer is it depends on what you're cooking. But let's talk about cooking for a minute, because there's a strong belief, and I believe in this belief too, this theory, that one of the things that set humans apart from all the other creatures is we figured out how to cook our food. And I believe we've talked about this in the past. Like if you compare our intestinal tract to that of our nearest primate relatives, we have an incredibly short digestive system while they have a very long digestive system. Because what happens when you cook food is you break down a lot of the proteins and a lot of the starches and a lot of other things that normally would take a long time for our digestive juices to chew up and probably wouldn't before it exited the other end. But by cooking it, we pre-digest it. So it's already partially digested. And so our bodies can access the nutrients from it immediately or almost immediately. So we don't need this incredibly long digestive tract. Same thing is going on with the fermentation. It's another form of pre-digestion of the food, breaking down the starches and other things that our body normally would not be able to access. But now, because it's pre-broken down before we eat it, yep, it's good to go for us. So, you know, like cooking carrots versus fermenting carrots, in the end, you're going to have very similar nutritional values. And as far as cooking, yes, there are certain compounds that are damaged by heat. A prime example is vitamin C. We know we need vitamin C every day. We can't store vitamin C. It's crucial for a bunch of different reactions in the body. But for every minute above 184 degrees Fahrenheit, you lose 10% of the vitamin C. Now, a lot of other vitamins and minerals and so forth are much more temperature sensitive, like sugars start to caramelize around 350, 375, but even the caramelized sugars we can access fine. So that doesn't cause a problem. starches at those temperatures, they start breaking down from complex starches into sugars. The sugars are much easier to digest. The proteins, it doesn't matter. Well, what happens when you heat a protein is you just change its shape. The protein usually has a very specific molecular shape that allows it to do a very specific job. When we're eating that protein, we're not eating that protein so it will do that particular job in our body. We are looking at it as a source of amino acids that we are going to rip apart and reassemble in the proteins we need. And so the process of cooking that kind of opens up the proteins, breaks them down a little. It doesn't damage the individual amino acids. They're still there. They may just not be as connected tightly to each other. So again, we can access those amino acids more quickly because they're already partially digested. So as far as cooking goes, in many, many, many cases, it increases the nutritional value available for us humans to access.
Okay.
I just ticked off a whole bunch of raw foodists out there, but so be it.
Well, you know, they'll be fine.
The truth hurts.
Well, sometimes it can. So, you know, we're getting into kind of maybe canning season never really ended, but now that it's sort of traditionally getting into canning season, one of the things there's lots of things as far as sanitation goes. When you're doing canning, sanitation is absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. One of the things that can go wrong, and partly is from a poor job of canning, is your product can become a good host to a pathogen called botulism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at a can or a jar of something that has botulism and open it, it's going to look like it's fermented because it's kind of bubbly and spewy and it's got bubbles coming out of it. Well, that's kind of what we are used to seeing, is certainly in a fermented beer, maybe in like a champagne or sparkling wine. So they look the same, but yeah, how what happens to you is not the same. So when we're looking at fermenting something, say we want to make sauerkraut at home. I'm going to get, and maybe people have seen those really nice two-tone crockeries. Say, wow, this is great. I'm going to make sauerkraut. What can go wrong? How do we know it's gone bad?
Okay, another good question. And just to go sideways for a second, the issue with botulism is not just that the bacteria can like grow and overwhelm things, but the waste products that it creates when it's eating the different foods are extremely toxic to us. So even if you have food that is contaminated with botulism, if you cook it and kill the botulism bacteria, the poisons they created are still there. And
that's
it could cause all sorts of, yeah, that's a problem. So how do you avoid that when you are doing the fermented cabbage type stuff? And just to go back to the beginning, the whole salt issue, the botulism does not like a salty environment. If you're making cabbage, the basic recipe is 5 pounds of finely diced cabbage and 1.5 tablespoons of salt just smashed together. And at that concentration, the salt is going to draw fluid out of the cabbage and make a brine that is way more appropriate for the lactobacillus than the botulism bacillus. And I can't remember the specific scientific, botulism colostrum or something like that. And so it's going to outproduce. So as long as you've sterilized the jar, stick them in boiling water for a bit, and then put the crushed up cabbage with salt, if you have enough salt in there, and then you keep it submerged. You can buy if you're just using like a wide mouth bottle, you can buy these glass discs that are designed specifically for this sort of fermentation of sauerkraut and anything else, where the glass disc then weights down and keeps all the cabbage and whatever else you have in there submerged in that brine which is not favorable for the botulism bacteria to grow, but is favorable for the lactobacillus. So the goal is to really, really, really stack the deck for the lactobacillus, and it will quickly outproduce and override any of the other bad bacteria in there. A lot of times the botulism is more for like meat and things that aren't acidic or salty.
Or not acidic enough, like tomatoes.
Yeah.
You know, back when I was teaching culinary school, one of the classes I taught was sanitation. And it's not an exciting class, but it's there's a lot a cook needs to know about cooking food safely and handling food properly. And this is a kind of inside baseball, but one of the things that's interesting about things like botulism is it lives, thrives in an oxygen-free environment, an anaerobic environment. So it's, and then there's this thing, there's this safety system it has called going into a spore, where you can't kill it. There's nothing you can do to spore that's going to destroy the spore, because it's this superhero, well, hero's the wrong word, but this
almost like a chunk of rock.
Yeah, it's just, it's impervious to anything you can do with it. You can't boil it, you can't freeze it. When it removes itself from this protective rock coating, now it goes back to doing what it's doing, which is making poisonous excretions. So, and it's not the bug that kills you, it's the waste.
Yep.
So that's kind of confusing. It's a bit like, wait a minute, why do I need to know this? But when you're making your kimchi or your sauerkraut, keeping the plate, keeping the disc, keeping something on top so that all of the stuff is below the surface of the liquid. Now, maybe it's an anaerobic environment, but it's inhospitable to the botulism, so it's going to go into spore mode. Then it's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention is that cabbage, when we bought a champion juicer years ago, one of the cautions was, if you make cabbage juice, drink it immediately. Because if cabbage juice is allowed to sit for half an hour or so, it changes and turns into a mild form of cyanide. So probably best to avoid that. When we're salting our cabbage and drawing out the liquid from the cabbage, Are we making a salty cyanide solution in that sauerkraut?
That's interesting. I have never, in all my studies and all my time, I've never encountered cabbage making cyanide. It's very common for grass. So I have to look into that. I've never heard it. I've never encountered. I'm very curious. And I have ways of testing that. So,
all right, well, follow the science.
Yeah.
And I'm
if anything, there might be some sulfides, like a little bit of hydrogen sulfide, but not enough to be, you know, the rotten egg sort of smell. But even that, tiny, and quickly gone. I'm gonna have to look at it. I'm not 100% convinced.
Okay.
But I'll look it up.
So sauerkraut. Would you classify sauerkraut as a long fermentation or a short fermentation?
I guess it depends on your definition of long and short. So really, when I'm making sauerkraut, I don't even do anything with it for at least 4 weeks. I just let it, you know, bubble away. I will say, along with the glass disc, then I also have a like a cotton bandana over the top to keep other things from in the air floating in there. But it is producing gas, so you need some sort of venting sort of thing. But yeah, 4 to 8 weeks is not uncommon for me to let a, you know, just a jar of sauerkraut ferment on our countertop doing its thing.
So compare that to a sourdough bread, even though your starter may take a couple of days. Oh, I've had my starter for 97 years. Well, it's actually not the same starter, but that's another conversation. there was no cell in there 97 years old. And the bakers get mad at me when I say that. Oh, my goodness. And that's okay. They have a passion, and I can appreciate passion. I think that would be a long one. If we're doing fermentation and someone's saying, you know, I don't really want to wait 4 to 8 weeks for my fermented product to be done, I think sour cream, you can do that in a little thing on the countertop in a couple of days. Creme fraiche, that's just fermented.
A lot of it has to do with food for the lactobacillus. is there enough food in it for it to quickly reproduce? And when you have bread, you have a lot of starch. You have things breaking down the starch. You have the, you know, the bacteria in there, especially in sourdough bread, that's breaking down some of the starch and giving it to the yeast. Long story short, it's a very fast process. And you quickly reach the point where the waste products produced by the yeast and the lactobacillus are starting to kill the sourdough, which is why pretty much every day or every other day, you got to swap out half of it. The food available for the cabbage, you know, when you're making the sauerkraut, isn't quite as readily available. And so it takes a little longer a time. So that's, and partially, this is somewhat of a swag, SWAG, scientific wild ass guess. But if you look at it, the growth rate of the lactobacillus in the sauerkraut is slower, at least at the initial stages, just because the food isn't as readily available. But as it starts to break things down and freeze up more of the starches and the celluloses and all that, then it does catch up to it. But if you just waited 4 days with your sauerkraut, you're not going to have much flavor. I would say it's going to take, you know, 4 days. You might just start to see the bare, very basic sort of things going on. It is a much slower process than the sourdough bread.
Now, after 4 days, it's going to look the same. It's going to be all wilty, pretty much.
No? I mean, what the cabbage would look like after 4 days and after 4 weeks?
Yeah.
No. There's going to be a visible difference, and the bubbling and a slight murkiness, things like that. Okay, now, that being said, I'm approaching it from at least a somewhat experienced eye. And so someone who's just making it for the first time may not quite see the subtle differences. So
Right. There
is that side too, yeah.
Does ambient temperature make a difference?
Yes, because like anything else, the lactobacillus does have a preferred temperature, and it actually likes things on the cool side, in the low 70s, and also out of sunlight. It doesn't want to be exposed to sunlight. Because the sunlight kills, you know, any sort of.
That's why those sauerkraut crockeries are dark, because the sun can't get in them.
as opposed to
down the root cellar.
Yep. So you do actually get a faster effect if it's actually a lower temperature than, let's say, at a higher temperature. The bacteria actually doesn't like that, so it'll actually take longer. If you're up, say, at 80 degrees, and if you're at, say, 70 degrees or 68 degrees, you'll get...
That's counterintuitive to lots of things we think about when it comes to temperature, like sourdough bread. Mm-hmm. You're going to get, if you go slow, you will get a spectacular bread, but it's going to take a couple of extra days. Whereas you go fast, you'll get a lot of rise, but you won't have...
Yeah. And
flavor is a weird thing to try to describe or explain, because... Aside from what one's palate can detect, and there's no way of knowing how ours differs, the other thing that really changes in a long fermented thing like sauerkraut or in a sourdough bread is the lingering flavor notes after you swallowed it, and that's one of the things that. Beer, a good beer to a degree, and certainly with wine and cheeses, is okay. I'm getting this immediate flavor, but then the wine guys will sit and they look snobby when they go taste in the air. But what they're really looking for is what other notes are here, and that's where you end up getting that leather or that olive or those stone fruits, and that's where it becomes like, oh, this is a lot of fun, and then. That can't be rushed. You can't. So a sourdough bread is going to end up, and this is why it's crazy, is just with salt, water, flour, yeast, you're getting all of this astonishing back note flavors that, like, there's no way you can hurry that up. And
those flavors are actually due to the other waste products of the bacteria and the yeast. And that's why you have, you know, if you get bacteria or yeast from different areas, they're genetically similar, but not exactly the same. And so what they excrete, what they break things down into is going to be somewhat different. And then the longer time you give them to excrete into the pot, right, the richer, more complex flavors you'll get.
Now, I know with bread, there is a point of entropy where you have no choice. Now you simply must bake the bread.
Right.
Does that point of entropy happen with sauerkraut? And then when you get there, what do you have to do? Can you let, will you, so I guess the question is, what do you have to do? If you don't can it, do you risk losing the benefits that have been built over, let's just say 8 weeks? You've been fermenting this sauerkraut for 8 weeks. It's all bubbly and smelly and all of this good beneficial bacteria in there. We're going to call it by a term probiotic. We're going to talk about that in a minute. If I wait 9 weeks, is my probiotic benefit being diminished because something is changing inside that canister?
Okay, great question. So there are two ways of answering that, the traditional way and the FDA approved way. Okay. So
here they come again.
Yeah. So like with alcohol, the reason, like, let's say you have a beer, the beer ends up being 7.8% alcohol. That's because the particular yeast that was being used, once the alcohol level gets above 7.8, it kills the yeast. Like anything, yeast or lactobacillus, there is a certain amount when they have produced so much waste product that they can no longer survive. People always talk about humans are the only ones that destroy their environment. No, every yeast, every bacteria in a bottle you're going to eat or drink has reached the point where it's produced so much waste that it kills itself, or most of the live bacteria in there. Because remember, there's always this bell curve. And so some of the bacteria could only handle, and I'm pulling numbers out of the air here, you know, could only handle 7% lactic acid, and some could only handle 11, but some can go up to like 28% lactic acid. So the window between 4 months and 8 months is kind of like the ideal situation where the strongest amount of probiotic and most of the stuff is already pre-digested. So you're in that window, that good window. If you let it continue to go, and, you know, down in the root cellar in a crock with the cover on it, you know, in cool area, it will sit there. You will, because you have the salt there and you have it covered, you're not likely to introduce some new bacteria into it. So it's going to just sit there doing its own thing. If you eat it 6 months later, 8 months later, you're still going to get some live bacteria in there. There's going to be some hanging around that are just so damn tough that even that didn't kill them. And so they'll be just kind of chilling. And those are going to be the ones that are reproducing. So, you know, you're going to have a very strong one by that point. Now, according to the FDA, after about 8 weeks or so, if you want to do long-term storage rather than just constantly munching out of it, if you would just want to put it in a jar and set it on the shelf, they really recommend that you do a simple water canning to it. You cap it, you put it in boiling water for, I forget how long, maybe 30 minutes or so, until the temperature has penetrated all the way through the cabbage. And then you take it out and it self-seals the jar, you know, the little pop pops like you're normally canning. But then you just do a water, it doesn't need a pressure canning. It, you can just do a boiling water canning to store it. But in doing so, you have killed even more of the bacteria. There may be a few that have survived, but you've reduced the ability of this pasteurized sauerkraut now to reintroduce the lactobacillus, live lactobacillus, into our gut. So you're still going to get some of the other nutritional value from it, but you are not getting the live lactobacillus at that point.
Like, if so when you're walking down New York getting your sauerkraut hot dog, that sauerkraut is pasteurized, heat treated, and then sitting in this hot cart for how many hours? So it tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
And I can attest to a New York City dirty water hot dog with sauerkraut and grain mustard. Mm-hmm. Pretty damn tasty. And then there's the stewy onions. Oh, my God. But from a probiotic standpoint, you ain't getting nothing.
Correct.
Okay. So.
Empty food.
Well, but it tastes good. So that's a battle.
Yep.
From a probiotic standpoint. So sauerkraut, if we want, and it's. Now, I can buy kimchi in the store that hasn't been pasteurized. And I've got some in the cooler because it's easier to buy it than make it. And I like it because I know, one, it's raw and it's got all the things I want in there. And I eat a little bit every day and I think I'm doing my gut a good service. And
maybe
I'm fooling myself, but I don't know. I don't even know. I mean, this is a shopping question. Is sauerkraut available in the raw form?
That's a good question. I believe there is. In the refrigerated section with a relatively short lifespan. One of the problems when you have that live bacteria is it is still producing gases from the fermentation. So when your first time you crack it open, you might get a little burst of air. Now, one thing you can do, because you do have the live kimchi and you have that live bacteria in it, you can use that fluid as a starter to just add to some more shredded cabbage, and you're ahead of the game with the lactobacillus. You still want the salt, but you add that into there. And in that case, I don't know if you could get it in 4 days, but you could definitely speed up the process. So it might be worth trying that way.
The company or somebody has invented a very clever top.
Oh, that's
which lets the gas come out, but it's still... It's plainly it's sealed, so you have peace of mind as the consumer that you're not getting something that someone looked at. Like, remember the ice cream?
Open it up, so, licked it, put it back.
People. So from my point, it's like, good. This is sealed. I'm confident no one put something else in there I don't want, but somehow it's still able to breathe, and that's cool. So fermented things. Like then wine. So if we're looking for, now there are other reasons to either drink or not drink wine, and some of them are preferences and religious reasons and other cultural reasons. But from a probiotic standpoint, and beer, are they pasteurized? Is that just not going to? I mean, drink them because they taste good, but you're not getting any probiotics out of that.
Correct. The yeast really doesn't grow well in the body. And the one place the yeast can grow fairly decently is generally a place you don't want things growing. So, unfortunately, with the yeast type stuff, you're generally better off having the dead yeast as opposed to the alive bacteria. Remember, yeast is a fungi. Yep. Generally, humans and fungi, they have a tasty relationship, but not necessarily completely beneficial in all ways, shapes, and forms.
Now in the U.S., it's hard to find and obtain raw cheese, but if you can, is raw cheese going to be a good source or any source of probiotics?
Yes. So again, that's going to be a bacteria-based sort of thing, an acid-loving sort of bacteria. So same with yogurt. Those are things, if you are put on antibiotics and it's killed your gut bacteria, the good bacteria, they say have things like the apple cider vinegar that still has the raw bacteria in it and the yogurt and things like that. Yeah, the stinky cheeses, all those things will help build the gut flora back up.
Stinky cheese. It was a family story for years that my mom's dad, my grandpa, lied about his age so he could drive a streetcar in Detroit when they still had streetcars. And grandpa's preferred lunch was a Limburger cheese and onion sandwich. And the joke was he never had trouble getting people to the back of the bus. And I have not once in nearly 60 years tried Limburger cheese. And I feel I have this cultural obligation to do at least once. So tell me why I need to eat Limburger cheese.
Okay. My parents love Limburger cheese. Growing up as a kid, they'd go, the butcher shop had it. They'd also get some head cheese to go with it, you know, where you melt down a pig's head. Yeah. And oh, yeah. Just a Limburger and head cheese sandwich was good eaten by them. And us kids and our friends, we would just leave the house because it does smell so terrible. But I, you know, as a parent, you do force your kids to do things. And I actually ate it and it tastes a lot better than it smells. As far as the bacteria in it, yeah, it's beneficial. But overall, yogurt and things like that are just as easy way of getting it. It's going to be breaking down in particular the lactose, the sugar. That's the particular one that the sticky cheeses like. At least that's my understanding. Someone out there might say, no, it's this other sugar in milk. But lactose is generally the main sugar in milk. I don't know the exact specific bacteria that is responsible for Lindbergh. Like your grandfather's passengers, I probably tried to avoid it as much as possible. Even though, I mean, it was more than weekly. There was always a chunk of Limburger cheese there. And I just pretty much blocked it from my memory because it is so, so horrible smelling. But I have noticed when I go home and visit my folks, yet they still have the Limburger cheese, and it, for whatever reason, it does not smell as bad now as it did when I was a kid. And they do show, like, the sense of smell and so forth changes over time, the sense of taste. And it could be that part of it is you kind of lose some of your sense of smell and your sense of taste as you age. And so maybe I've lost enough now where the Limburger isn't horrific.
I don't know. Can any food be fermented?
Ooh, that's a good question. So pretty much any vegetable or starchy root can be fermented using this lactobacillus type thing. When I used to work down in Mexico, they would have just like these fermented carrots and radishes and daikon radishes and celery and onions, all sliced really thin. The trick when you're doing it is you don't want thickness. You want the things diced up like coleslaw or thin because you need the lactic acid to permeate into the vegetable, the root, the structure of it. So like when you're making cabbage, sauerkraut, slice out the thick vein that runs through the leaf because it's actually too thick. Unless you really dice it up well, it's not going to safely be lactic acid fermented. So you need thin slices. At the Korean barbecue that my daughter likes, they have these fermented daikon radishes. They look like white Pringle chips, you know, the potato chips. They're that thin, but they've been the fermented with the lactobacillus, and they're absolutely delicious. So you just need to make sure the food is sliced very thin.
The lactobacillus doesn't travel well into cellulose product.
Right. It hangs out on the surface, and then the lactic acid that it makes and some of the other things, those are what penetrate into the food and kill anything else there. Now, luckily, the regular bad bacteria can't really get in there either, but it's just as a extra protection.
You know, there's nothing wrong with
seat belts, you know, and airbags sort of thing.
Well, you know, extra protection in food is I'm fine. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's okay. Because getting sick from eating food is
miserable.
It is. And of all the things to avoid experiencing in the world, foodborne illness and foodborne poisoning are two things that are, I advise steering clear of handily. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to experience that. There's lots of joy in the world. Go figure out what that is. All right. So let's, you know, the last couple of times you were on, I think somehow I avoided asking you my food questions. Huh. So before we move into that, is there something in this vast mix of fermentation that I haven't asked that you want me to know?
The main thing is once you no proper sanitation techniques, the overall process is very, very, very easy. If you think about it, a lot of these traditional ancient foods, they did not have the time and resources and equipment to do a lot of processing and so forth like that. It was something they whipped together and away they went. And
like Og and Sally.
Yeah, Og and Sally. I like Og and Sally. I'm going to use them for a lot of things. But in this day and age, real food has become more and more rare. Ancestral foods has become more and more rare because we want to go to the grocery store and we think it's convenient to go to the grocery store and get the stuff and then just eat it, even though it's been pasteurized and killed. One of the things I do when I'm teaching my cooking classes is, you know, people are shocked how easy this is. But I also point out, okay, now you know how easy this is. Throw a party. Have a sauerkraut making party. Have a pasta making party. Get your neighbors involved. Get that social side. Teach them how easy it is, how good it is. Build your circle of influence, but build your tribe. Because in the end, we are social creatures. And food and sharing food and making food together is a wonderful experience because I got all these strangers working together. And by the end, they're on each other's Facebook friend accounts and all this sort of thing because they're like, wow, that was great. I had a good time. There's just a mood lifting thing that occurs when you're cooking with people.
That's a fabulous idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, especially now, you know, we need to figure out how to be around people again. We need to learn how to be around people again. So cooking together is a great way of doing it. And if you're teaching food preservation and food safety, make sure you understand the food safety. It's a great way of just building a community through food. You have some wine, you have some mead that you made, you know, things like that, and away you go.
That's a brilliant idea. That really is a great idea. I like that. Folks, let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
So, moving into the little short answer part of the show, and even if we did talk about this, I'm curious to see if your answers have changed. I'm going to have to go listen to both episodes, and I don't think I asked you these. Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, or umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
Ooh, that's a toughie. I have to admit, I have a terrible sweet tooth. If there's an Oreo cookie in the house, my Oreo cookie sense will find said cookie. So as much as I hate to admit it, I have to be truthful to myself and say the sweet.
What's your favorite
with
food?
With bitter. Ooh. I gotta love pizza because you can do so many different things with pizza and include all those different flavors on it. Or just a good steak, one or the other. But I like complex flavors, so I love curries and all the different things you can do with curry. But again, you know, Thole, you're trapped on a desert island, you can only eat one food for the rest of your life. Give me a supreme pizza and the onions, the peppers, the mushrooms, the pepperoni, the sausage, the bacon, the Canadian bacon, pineapple. Yes, I'll put pineapple on a pizza. So that rich and the texture and the cheese and the, pizza.
Okay. What's your least favorite food?
Blood sausage.
Oh.
The German blood sausage. And part of it was we used to make it every fall. We'd butcher a pig. And the head cheese, seeing a pig's head melt on the stove over the course of hours and, overnight and so forth was kind of creepy, but there was something about the smell of blood sausage when my mom would make that, even after the spices and stuff were added to it and the breadcrumbs and all that. There's just something psychological that I can't do blood sausage. If you don't tell me what it is, I'd probably be fine. But I might also quickly figure it out because I ate enough of it growing up that it's like, it's hard to hide on me.
All right. What gets you excited?
Whew. Okay, so I'm assuming we're talking food. And in that case, I love, like you experienced, teaching people how easy it is to make good food. Now, to make great food, yeah, that requires more effort. But to make good food, you know, just a simple pasta, you know, when you got some flour, some egg, a little oil, a little water, a little salt, and some effort into it, and seeing them go, wow, this actually tastes really good, and it was relatively easy. It was somewhat time consuming, but it was fun. And so just seeing that eye opening, wow, I don't have to buy prepackaged food for every meal, trying to get them back. And now let's talk about the wild foods, you know, and all this stuff around there. And now you can use that in these dishes and it tastes great. So yeah, just reconnecting people to nature through food is what gets me excited.
What turns you off?
Oh, so many things. Okay. One of the things, so on the whole medicine man plant co side, the medicinal plant side, constantly getting people saying, plants are just snake oil. They don't have any medicinal properties. Plants have no effect on humans as they drink their coffee and smoke their marijuana. And it's like, really, dude? You think plants have no powers? What's in your cabinet? What's in your glove compartment? You know, it's not just those two things. There's all sorts of rich biochemistry going on in plants. And science has shown that, yes, these have these effects. And so just dealing with the naysayers and the... a few days ago on my Facebook page, I pointed out that the original source of aspirin was willow bark, and that the compound in aspirin, when it hits our stomach acid, it basically gets converted into willow or into aspirin. And how they found, so one of the effects of aspirin is it reduces blood clotting. One of the effects of COVID is blood clots in the lungs. So doctors have started, just as a preventative, when you have COVID, to put you on a daily dose of aspirin too, to help reduce the chance of any of the blood clots forming in the lungs. And so I pointed out that, and I had people say, oh, you're going to kill people. You're telling them to treat COVID by chewing willow trees. And it's like, no, did you not read what? Yeah. So yeah, people like that jump to straw man arguments and all that just drive me up a wall. And it's very hard not to nuke them from space, but engage in them logically and, you know, trying to educate them. Here's a secret for all your viewers who end up in arguments on social media. Don't bother trying to convert the initial commenter. Who you are trying to convert are all the people quietly sitting on the fence going, I wonder if there's anything to this. So present your arguments for them, because you're not going to be able to change the mind of the initial commenter, but focus more on trying to win over the unsung people that are just sitting in the backgrounds, not saying anything, but learning from you.
That's good advice.
Free advice there.
What sound do you love?
Oh, the wind in the trees. Wind in general. Wind anywhere. I love the sound of wind. It's the sound of change and new things coming. Yeah.
What sound do you hate?
The beeping of the smoke detector when it's time to replace the battery. Because that usually happens at like 3 a.m. And then I got to find a battery. I got to find a screwdriver. Yeah. If you had to pick a sound I hate, that would be the sound.
What's your favorite food indulgence?
Going back to pizza, washed down with a good beer. After I've been on a multi-day adventure out in the woods, burning up the calories and not getting enough back. Me and my buddies, we got this one pizza joint that we are filthy, covered in mud, and they welcome us in open arms. And we get the supreme pizza and big old pints of beer and release our inner pizza-loving hobbits.
That sounds awesome.
Oh, it's so good.
Dr. Mark, I think you're a romantic at heart.
I am.
For fermentation, do you have any book recommendations you have for people who say, you know, this sounds like something I want to pursue?
Oh, yes. Pascal Batter's book, Wild Fermentation. So he has three books out, but Pascal, if you just look up Pascal, last name, I think it's Bader, Pascal Bader. He is a wild foods expert. He's a foraging instructor like me, but his specialty is wild fermentations with that. And you know, basically how to hollow out a log, pack it with some assorted greens and a little salt, put a rock on top of it and let it go. And it turns into amazing things. So he has one on the lactobacillus type fermentation. He has one on the yeast alcohol type fermentation. And then he also has just a general cooking wild things. So Pascal Balder's wild fermentation book. And then also Katz. I can't remember his first name, but K-A-T-Z. He has a book also, Wild Fermentations. That's really good.
Sounds like he's doing our Og and Sally stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Pascal. Yeah, most definitely.
Very interesting. All right, and how can people follow you on social media?
So the center of my universe is now the MedicineManPlantCo.com. MedicineManPlantCo.com. And from there will be links to my YouTube channel, my Facebook, my Instagram. I just started TikTok, so expect weird dances and stuff like that.
There's a lot of ER people out of work. They can help you.
Yeah. Good point. Also, all the other podcasts I've been on for, maybe not as good as this one, but still pretty good. Pretty good, so. You can expand your horizon.
I will put links to the books and to Medicine Man Plant Co. on the show notes page, which is culinarylibertarian.com/163. Mark, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate your time this midday.
It's, as usual, a wonderful time to be here. I like the questions you ask because they come kind of from your background, which is a very cool background for the cooking and all that. And so, especially the food safety things. That's something that I really need to talk more about in these sort of things.
Yeah, it's...
like in the live classes, I'm rigorous about that because I don't want 14 people with food sickness.
Well, one of the points to drive the point home was in teaching a culinary class is there's always... even if it's 30 years ago, there's always an example of something that went very, very wrong. And in Tallahassee, many years ago, there was a place called Jake's Barbecue. And I never met them. It was never there. It closed before I got there. But it was famed for spectacular barbecue and also famed for not having hot running water. Ooh. So the cooks had nobody to wash their hands or utensils. So, Jake's Barbecue was serving a barbecue and more. And lots of people got violently sick at Jake's, and now Jake's is no more. So, it's not for nothing that sanitation is preached a lot because things can go really, really bad. And it's not just like, ooh, I don't feel good. I'm going to go sit in this toilet for a couple of hours. It can be the point that it's rare, but it can take your life or make you wish it did.
And organ failure, especially with the botulism.
So let's avoid that. So,
yep.
Anyway, yeah. So it's a big deal, and it's worth paying attention to and getting it right, and it's worth throwing the food away if it didn't come out right. Because don't do that to your friends; they won't be your friends.
Yeah, and that's one of the things my wife and I argue about. She's the type that will pull out some frozen chicken breast and set it on the counter for 6 hours. It's like, are you trying to kill us?
My mother did that. That's how you did it. You put stuff on the counter all day and then come home and cook it.
Oh, no.
That's what we did.
That's why I do most of the cooking now.
All right. Well, for other reasons, I do most of the cooking, but it has something to do with my background, I think.
Understandable.
All right. Well, thanks again. I'm going to let you run. I saw my wife called, so I'm going to go take care of that. I appreciate it.
Ditto. Every preacher loves a new pulpit.
That's right.
This isn't even a new pulpit anymore for me. It's a very comfortable pulpit.
That's good. I'm glad you feel welcome here. I appreciate
yes.
it.
Yes.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll put the previous episode links to Mark's appearances on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/163. I'll also add the links to the two books Mark mentioned on that same show notes page. Please share this episode around on your social media feeds and like it when you see it. And also, like the podcast on your favorite podcatcher and leave a rating and a review, please. That helps the podcast gods or mice or whatever's in there show it to more people, and that gets us a bigger audience. I would appreciate your support on the support page, culinarylibertarian.com/support, and you can join the Patreon or donate through PayPal. Thank you for listening, and have a good week. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.